faith should bring us together and not drive us apart. And we will all have differences in what we believe, but it should never be the thing in the workplace that drives us apart. But faith, for people that believe it, is a core part of who they are. And I always struggle when people don't believe they can share who they are. Like in the workplace, when you walk through that door, it should be created to allow you to bring the best version of yourself in the door every day. And if your faith is core to who you are, you should be able to talk about that. You should be able to express your beliefs in a way, again, that respect those around you, but that are clearly sharing who you are. It's not proselytizing. It's sharing why I am the way I am, what I believe and why I believe it.
Great companies are all about the people. Good people become great leaders, mentors for work and life.
Welcome to Learnings from Leaders, the P&G Alumni Podcast.
I'm Raman Sehgal, recovering marketer.
And I'm Rajiv Sethial, the funny Indian. Raman and I both got our start at P&G, the Procter & Gamble company, where we had the opportunity to work with some amazing people. And as you may know, many leaders across industries got their start at P&G. In this series, through conversations with fellow P&G alums, we hope to go deeper with the leaders you already know, but want to know more about.
It's kind of like bringing a microphone to a cup of coffee.
On today's show, we're talking to P&G alumni leader Kirk Perry. Kirk is the president and chief executive officer at IRI, which many of you will know is the company that deals in big data, analytics, and insights that power action and growth.
Prior to that, Kirk was at Google since 2013 as president of brand solutions. And prior to that, Kirk was at P&G for 23 years in various roles across marketing and general management, including the president of global family care and 6 years of his career in Asia with 3-year assignments in both South Korea and Japan. Him and his family are very active in giving back and supporting their communities, including the University of Cincinnati. And he served on the boards for the J.M. Smucker Company, Elf Cosmetics, the March of Dimes, and the Ronald McDonald House. So he's just really involved professionally and personally in his community. Kirk's definitely an in-the-moment guy, giving his all to whatever he's involved with. He makes it very clear that you've got to solve the business issue, the business deadline. But he's always taking a step back to put things in perspective.
We invited Kirk back on to discuss the topic of faith, normally a taboo topic in the workplace. But I love what Kirk had to say about how his faith has helped him navigate both his personal and his professional life. Let's dive right in. We hope you'll enjoy our conversation with Kirk Perry. Kirk Perry, we're so excited to have you. I've done a number of these. We've asked only a handful of alumni back, people that we felt have more wisdom to give. We want to deep dive on a certain topic. I sat down with Jim Lafferty. I'm sure you've crossed paths with him.
I know Jim well.
And I was stunned in a pleasant way at how open he was when it was one of these things where I just went, wow, that it didn't feel like a business podcast. And it did in the sense that there was still a lot of learning, but it felt very personal. And I really loved that. So, you know, some of us were talking about how great it would be to have Kirk Perry back to talk about his faith. And, you know, faith is something that isn't discussed a lot, certainly at work, but even in broader society. And I was really excited to jump in with you because they always say, no politics, no sex, no religion. Those are the three things at the Thanksgiving table, at work, wherever else. Leave those things alone. And even if, let's assume that last one is not even in the realm of possibility. So, well, I do have a number of questions, but I want to just leave it fairly open-ended to begin with, which is just to start by, why did you agree to come back and discuss this particular topic of faith? And what does faith mean to you?
Sure. So first of all, I enjoy this podcast immensely. It's one of the four that I regularly listen to. So I was excited and honored to be asked back. And for me, faith is such a core part of who I am. I enjoy talking about it because to your point, it is one of those things that conventional wisdom or society say, don't talk about. In fact, if you're listening less, Les Overway, when I joined the company in 1990, was a marketing director for healthcare. You know, we had lunch my first 2 weeks on the job and talking about various things, how to get off to a fast start. You know, I'm an undergrad, bright-eyed, bushy-tailed, like how do I navigate this corporate world? And I didn't know much about anything. And he said, hey, Kirk, one bit of advice I'd give you, three pieces to it. But the first is don't date anyone you work with. And I'm like, well, I'm married. So if I do, then I've got bigger issues than that. The second one was, don't talk politics. And the third one was, if you're religious, keep it to yourself.
Wow.
And I remember like, oh, you know, and if I could just give a little bit of context on my faith in general at that point in my life, I was a Christer, which means I went to Christmas and Easter services. In our house growing up, we were CEOs, Christmas and Easter only. And faith in our house was very much crisis driven. So my family was very blue collar. You know, we spent a year on welfare growing up, or we ran out of money before we ran out of month. And so we'd go to church when like there was crisis going on in the house. And that kind of was ingrained in me. The other one was about faith is it was very personal. You didn't share it because my dad would kind of jokingly, but not really, would say someone who talked openly about their faith was a Bible beater or a Bible thumper or a Jesus freak. So you hear those things as a kid and you think, okay, got to keep it kind of covered up. You can't share it openly because it's a personal thing or people will scorn you for it. And that's how I thought about it. And at that point in my life, faith was very theoretical, academic. I would probably argue I was agnostic. I believed theoretically in God, but I wasn't really sure because I had grown up very hard scrabble and like, where was God in my life at various points? I could go into a bunch of stories, but I wouldn't say I had a strong faith at all. And so Les's words to me were like, okay, yeah, it's not a problem on any of those fronts. And to add a little bit to that story, maybe a month later, someone named Jim Bechtold.
Yep.
Jim is to this day an incredibly close friend of mine. Started planting those seeds of faith in corporate America. I remember when he came and introduced himself, and Jim was probably 3 years senior to me in the company, and said, "Hey, we do a 6 a.m. Bible study like Thursday mornings every other week." First of all, 6 a.m. Bible studies did not appeal that much to me because we were just talking about at the time how we were living in Fairfield. So that was, you know, I would have to leave the house at 5:15 to get to the GO by 6 a.m. And I'm like, yeah,
right.
The time wasn't great. But the other one was,
your faith there was more like, is 75 South going to be open? That's the faith you had.
Pretty much. Exactly. And so I said, well, Jim, you know, I mean, I've got, you know, this, I basically lied so I could get out of this. And Jim kept persisting. He kept inviting me and he never quit inviting me. But I always came up with excuses and never came. But to his credit, Jim would take me to lunch. We'd go to breakfast occasionally, and he would plant these seeds. And another guy named Greg Diener, who used to work for the company as well, and another good friend of mine to this day. Greg also was very overtly faithful. And, you know, he would ask me questions about my faith, and I was very academic and very closed off. And so anyway, all that to say, when Les had that conversation with me that day, it kind of cemented maybe what I had already thought I would do. And if someone would have said to me 33 years later that you have become an open advocate sharing your faith in a very respectful way, I would have laughed at them if someone would have told me that 33 years ago.
Okay. That's really great context to have, because I think, you know, being in the minority, being a Hindu, and seeing Christianity to us, I assume you're Christian.
Yes, I am.
Okay. So at this point, we have this sort of outside in of, oh, the whole country is Christian and we're off to the side and we've got this little kind of weird forearm God kind of thing going on, right?
Yeah.
And that's not accurate. I mean, I remember having a conversation with a couple of friends out here, and they're both from Tennessee, they're Protestants. And, you know, we were having a conversation about the schism in Hinduism over some particular thing. And they said, we go through it too. And I go, oh, tell me more. Like, I know Martin Luther and Catholicism and Eastern Orthodox, I know all that. They go, no. Like, we had a falling out with another church because we wanted to play music like on an electric guitar. And they didn't. They were like, no, there's no guitar in church. And there was a schism, and one church went one way and one went another. And to us, it's very monolithic. But I think when you're in it, it's not like that at all.
Yeah. And what's fascinating is you point out something very incredibly true about the Christian faith. It is as splintered and different as, you know, my wife grew up Southern Baptist. And the first time I went to church with her, I wanted to like fall back in my chair. You know, it was like hellfire, brimstone. The pastor's wiping the corner of his mouth and his face is red. I'm like, oh my gosh, for a guy that goes twice a year, this is scary. You know, and then we go to a place in town now called Crossroads. And Crossroads is open to anyone because, you know, it's a place that focuses on people who've given up on church, but not on God. And so I think even in my P&G journey, back to your point, like you're Hindu, I have had the richest faith-based conversations because I'm open about my faith with people of the Hindu faith, the Muslim faith, even atheists, having conversations about why I believe what I believe. And I, you know, spent almost 8 years at Google, very similar there in the Bay Area, where, you know, over half the people that live in San Francisco Bay Area are not born in the United States.
Yeah.
And so having conversations from people from around the world about faith and their differences. I mean, my belief is we all share the same creator. Mm-hmm. And so how someone interprets that is for us to learn and to respect, because that ultimately to me is the way to respectfully share your faith. Is my job is not to convert people to my faith. That's God's job. My job is to share what I believe and why I believe it in a way that doesn't alienate, offend. You know, I think sometimes people are so zealous in every faith, zealous in convincing each other that we're the only one, that we stop looking at what's common. You know, Deb Henretta, boss of mine at P&G, used to say as common as possible is different as necessary. And I think when you look at commonalities of faith, there are very core constructs across each of the faith disciplines in the world. And people tend to focus on the differences, not on what's similar. And a woman named Kate Shapira Latz, Kate used to work for me at P&G. She and her husband, Alan, run Heaven Hill Distillery in Bardstown, Kentucky. It's a family business. But Kate, when she left P&G, gave me a book called The Jewish Book of Why. It was a really intriguing book that I read from cover to cover about Jewish faith, customs, symbolism, but it gave me such a much deeper insight into her faith than I had ever had. And then when I moved to California, I had a taxi driver. His name was Muhammad from Pakistan. He was Muslim. And I had the richest faith-based conversations with that guy. When I got sick, I had stage 4 cancer in 2015.
Oh, wow.
And Muhammad and I were close enough at that point, after a couple of years of him taking me back and forth to the airport, he came over to my house and he would pray outside on his prayer rug as part of his prayers during the day. And so I think faith should bring us together, not drive us apart. And we will all have differences in what we believe, but it should never be the thing in the workplace that drives us apart. I mean, I'm in Cincinnati, you're in LA, but you know, Cincinnati right now has got Bengals fever.
Oh, I know.
And it's all over the news and people are wearing their shirts and they talk about it. And I'm sure at the water coolers and offices in Cincinnati, it's the talk of the town. But how many people like, and it's important, but it's sports, you know, it's big men playing a little kid's game. And yeah, it's amazing. But at the end of the day, you don't play, you're just a fan. But faith for people that believe it is a core part of who they are. And I always struggle when people don't believe they can share who they are. Like in the workplace, when you walk through that door, it should be created to allow you to bring the best version of yourself in the door every day. And if your Hindu faith is core to who you are, you should be able to talk about that. You should be able to express your beliefs in a way, again, that respect those around you, but that are clearly sharing who you are. And so, you know, that's kind of how I think about faith and work and being able to share in a way, like I said, is not proselytizing. It's sharing why I am the way I am, what I believe and why I believe it. Long-winded answer, but that's kind of how I think about, you know, being different, but being able to share it in a way that's respectful.
Oh, no, not long-winded at all. I was fascinated from the start to the finish. I always think of it at work, how thick is that mask you have to wear? And the thinner the mask that you put on when you open the door and walk into the GO, the thinner that is, the more you are yourself. But other people walk in, they feel like that mask is a mile thick. They can't be themselves at all.
Yeah.
And they're just not vibrating at the natural frequency of the building or the people or the culture. And I recently heard, you probably heard this many times, but some agency had come up with a corporate culture is, quote unquote, the way we do things around here. And I was like, oh, that's a good way of describing corporate culture. And let's start more in the business side of it, because I definitely have faith questions for sure. And I'm sure we'll get into this. But do you have do's and don'ts, best practices, sort of rules of engagement with faith? Do you have a one pager on it? Or how do you sort of integrate that into the workplace as a leader?
Yeah, so it's a great question. No, I don't have a white paper. I don't have a playbook. I believe that leadership is really simple. And I think that people see through platitudes. They see through phoniness. They see through playbooks. And so I always try to strive for being humble, authentic, and vulnerable in leadership situations or in leadership postures. What I mean by that is, you know, being who I am all the time. The incongruity sometimes that I used to live with, you know, I would be one way at work and another way outside of work.
Yeah, right.
You know, I describe it as, you know, when I think about, I'll be personal and share something I'm not terribly proud of, but it's true. So when I was younger, I would go to like strip clubs.
Okay.
And I thought about, like, I remember as I had kids, I'm like, is that woman is someone's daughter?
Sure.
But as I really found my faith and who I was, I'm like, is that authenticity to be saying that I believe something, but then do that? Like, is that really who I want to be? And so I think your faith gives you a grounding. And I think for me in the business world, my faith, if I live it out the way I should and follow what God wants me to be and do, then my faith should be permeating everything I do. So it should be a humble, authentic, and vulnerable extension of who I am. And I'll give you a couple of thoughts on that. One is, like, in the Bible, the word work or toil is mentioned 480 times.
Wow.
480 times. So it's pretty important to God that work is something that we do. You know, a lot of times we're like, oh man, let's just get through this world and go to heaven. Well, God put us here for a reason, right? It wasn't to be comfortable. It was to build our character and help us to be an impact on this world that he created. I think through work, right? So there's a scripture in the Christian New Testament, and it's Ephesians 6:6, and it says, work hard, but not just to please your masters when they are watching. The slaves of Christ, do the will of God with all your heart. Work with enthusiasm as you are working for the Lord rather than for people. And I think about that a lot as I have got my faith. It's like, no, I'm working for God. Like, now, before we go like, oh, wow, do you walk around with an I love Jesus, you know, flashing neon light on your forehead? No, and to your question, I talk about it in ways that would be natural conversations. I use words when I speak like blessed and grateful. Mm-hmm. If someone says, hey, what'd you do this weekend? And if I happen to do something faith-based, I'll share it. You know, some people say, hey, I went to the Bengals game, or went to the Reds game, or we went hiking, but I heard a great message at church yesterday that really impacted me. And so I try to make it in the, and then what happens is for people that aren't interested, I'm not offending them and I'm not doing anything that would cause them to be like, oh my gosh, he's trying to shove his Christian faith down my throat. For those who are interested, they'll ask me about it and say, hey, you mentioned something the other day. Like, I had somebody at P&G many, many years ago. When I was on stage, I said something about, I feel really blessed to have this job or whatever was going on. And I used to do office hours once a month for anybody that wanted to come in. And everybody came in and sat down. He said, hey, I just want to ask you a question. You use the word blessed. I'm guessing from maybe how you carry yourself that you're a believer. And I said, well, it depends on what you're asking, what I believe in. But, you know, he explained sort of how he thought I believed. And I said, well, that's kind of true. You know, I'm early walk Christian, but yes, this is why, you know, this is what I believe. And we had this great conversation that then became a regular ongoing back and forth, him asking me questions, me sharing, but again, never with the intent of cramming something into somebody, but rather letting them ask me why I am or believe the way I am. And I remember one thing that really, again, back to the extension of who you really are and being congruent, I try never to cuss during meetings. I'm not perfect at it, but I've always believed he's not professional to begin with. And that was one of the things P&G taught me, but also it just, not who I want to be. And again, I'm being faithful does not mean being perfect. Being faithful means to me, you're running towards something instead of away from something, you know? And so I want to try to be the best version of what God made me to be. And so I try not to do things that would cause people to go, oh, he says one thing, does another. And so when I was at Google for about a year, we were in a meeting and someone dropped the F-bomb and others were talking in the meeting and I didn't say anything. And so after the meeting, one of the women that I'd been working with over the last year, she pulled me aside and said, I just want to ask you, like, I watch people in meetings and observer of people, and people were dropping words in the meeting today that made me squirm a little bit. And I did too, you know, I said something, but you didn't even blink or respond in that way. Like, why are you that way?
Yeah.
It just opened up a discussion about why. I told her almost exactly what I just told you. I said, well, you know, my faith is important to me and I don't think God designed me to be that way, but you know, sometimes I slip up, but I try not to. And it's just what I believe. And I you can say whatever you want. You're an adult. And if that's what you want to do, or that's totally up to you. I'm not judging. I'm just saying that's how I want to be. And so mm-hmm. it just created a natural conversation for me to have about my faith. The other way I share it, but this is probably the way that I have learned how to do it, or I think for me, opens up who I really am. If I can tell you a story, weave a story, if you let me do that about how I came to my faith, it ultimately, and then how that played out and how I shared it. So I have four kids. My oldest turns 30 next month, which is weird to say out loud. We were just having this conversation earlier. She turns 30 next month. And when she was 6 years old, we found out she had kidney cancer. It's one of those things that makes you question everything in life. And it turned my world upside down. I mean, we were living in Korea at the time, and we had to come back to the U.S. to have her treated at Children's Hospital here in Cincinnati. And again, talk about what a gift that place is to the city and to the region. I mean, it's just the world. People come from all over the world, and particularly oncology, to be treated there. And she had kidney cancer and had her kidney removed. There's a whole long story to this. But ultimately, you know, P&G was amazing and like said, hey, Kurt, do what you have to do. If you have to move back to the U.S., we were planning on moving to Japan that fall anyway. They said, hey, we'll put your stuff in storage. We'll assume you're moving over there, but take back to the U.S. whatever you need. We'll rent you an apartment. I mean, the company could not have been better to us. But fast forward, we're back 6 weeks. She just started her chemo and came home from work one day. And I was working this weird shift because I kept my job in Northeast Asia. So I worked the night shift. So literally, I would start at night and I would work all night. And I'd sleep a little bit in the morning. And then I'd go into the office in Cincinnati because I was doing a project for Global Baby Care, which became Baby Stage of Development at that time. So it was and we had a kid with cancer. So I came up from work and I'll never forget it. Carly, who was then six, literally she was eating dinner. We were having spaghetti. Vividly remember it. She falls to the ground, writhing in pain for like 10 seconds. Picks herself back up, sits down, takes another bite of spaghetti. My wife and I, Jackie, are looking at each other like, what in the world just happened? And then 5 minutes later, drops to the ground, does it again. And so, you know, 15 minutes of this 5 minute pattern, it was almost like she was in labor pain. So called an oncologist. He's like, man, I think it sounds like something from the surgery. Cause when they take her kidney out, they cut her side to side and they open her up, took the kidney out. Like, sounds like something from the surgery. And we got rushed her down to Children's and put a tube down her nose. And surgeons think it's the chemo, the oncologists think it's the surgery. They brought a gastroenterologist, and this goes on for a week. Finally, on Saturday, I pulled the docs together. I'm like, hey, we've been here 5 days. We don't know what's going on. She's got a tube down her throat. She can't keep ice chips down. She's pumping a morphine drip every 10 minutes. Like, we got to figure this out. And I, in my mind, by the way, was like, there is no God. There's no way.
Right.
There is a God who loves the world that is letting my six-year-old daughter suffer. So I was kind of moving into agnostic to atheist. And I remember they had to rush her down to get an MRI. It was a big to-do, but we come up, we're in our room, we're like running down the hall. And the doctors come in and work behind the screen and they open it up and say, hey, can we see you in the hall? Which is never a good thing. And took us in the hall and they said, hey, good news is we think we figured out what's wrong. However, it's not going to be a pleasant fix. And they told us that they thought, that they knew she had a surgical adhesion from her kidney being removed, which blocked her colon. And when you have a peristaltic wave that gets blocked, it causes that severe pain. That's where that 5 minute rhythm came from. And they said, we're going to have to go in and we're going to have to clip part of her colon out and resect it where the adhesion is. But we think her colon is perforated, which means that she's had her stool in her system for the last week. And we think that we're going to have to leave her open. So leave my six-year-old daughter open after her surgery with antibiotics so she heals, and put a colostomy bag on her for 6 months. So we go down, they rush her down. She goes into surgery and we're in the waiting room. It was a beautiful Saturday morning in October, fall of 99. And our doctor comes out, it was supposed to be a 5.5 hour surgery in an hour. And we're the only ones in the waiting room, kicks the door open, comes out. He's got his gloves on, mask on, blood everywhere. You know, our hearts sink. And he said, hey, great news. We opened her up, no perforation, just a blockage. So we snipped the foot of her colon. We resected her. We sewed her up. She, no colostomy bag. She'll be in recovery in like an hour. So we're like, I mean, my head was spinning. And after he leaves, there's several points in the Bible where they say like Jesus wept or someone wept. And I'm not an emotional person, but the first time in my life, I wept. I like dropped to my knees. My wife and I were hugging. Just, I remember sobbing, like the point where my chest was like heaving. And I remember she pulled away from me. And my wife, who had a very difficult childhood, her dad was killed by a drunk driver when she was 3 years old. Her mom was married multiple times. She had a really rough childhood, but she always had a strong faith. And always, she was the faith rock in our marriage and the early part of our marriage anyway. And she pulled away from me and she grabbed me by the cheeks and said, "Do you realize how God must have felt when his son was hanging on the cross, screaming out, 'My God, why have you forsaken me?'" He could have stopped it, but he didn't. He loved us that much. We would have given our lives to stop Carly's pain, and we couldn't. That is how much God loves us. And it was the most, you hear about these like miraculous conversions. That was one for me. It so struck me to my core because I was living in that moment of seeing my daughter go through. And 23 years later, I still do this. Sorry.
No apology needed.
But I saw like up close, you know, I, for the first time, I was one of these people that thought I can fix anything. I can plow through anything, pull myself up on my bootstraps. I couldn't with this. I could not prevent her from being sick, getting better. I couldn't help her get better. I had no power, no control. It was the first time in my life I realized that even the challenges I had growing up, like God was always there with me. And it was this powerful, and I mentioned it earlier, it was a powerful transformation, not a perfection. Like I am probably so far away from the man God built me to be, but I strive to be better. And so the reason I'm sharing that story is when I got promoted to be a general manager, I was in Japan. I was in Northeast Asia living in, it was about 18 months after this. I was getting promoted and I'd just been through this, I forget what the training session at P&G was, but basically part of it was we were doing these life maps and people were putting on these sort of peaks and valleys in their life. You know, they said keep 3 to 4. And I thought, you know what? I'm going to be introducing myself. I'm young for a gentleman. I was in my early 30s.
Wow.
You know, I was in a foreign country with 90% of my organization being non-Western. So I'm like, I have to tell them who I really am. And so I laid awake that night. I'm like, all right, I'm going to share with them these 4 things about me, super personal things. And I finished up with a very brief version of the story of Carly. And each of the personal stories were about things that then translated to how I think about the business. Like my first one, being a poor kid growing up when my parents got laid off. And I'm like, hey, as a general manager, I will think about every decision I make, not from the lens of NPVs, from the lens of people impacted if I'm wrong. We can move headquarter people around if we're short on our budget for the year. But man, those line workers in Cape Girardeau or Green Bay or Mahoopany, like we're the only game in town. Like we better be right, more right than we're wrong because we're impacting people's lives. And so that was one. But when I got to the Carly story, I talked about it in the context of, I didn't say like, oh, this is my faith conversion. But I shared it in the context of how it shook me to my core as a dad because I was very honest and said, I was not a very good husband or dad for the first 6 years of her life and then her sister who was 3 years younger because I never wanted them to be on welfare like I was. And so I justified my 6 days a week, 12 hours a day by I don't want my kids to ever be in the same situation I am. And I'm like, that's wrong. Like I don't want that to be the case because today is called the present because it's a gift. You never get it back. Tomorrow's a dream. You know, yesterday is the past, but today is the present.
Memory.
And so, yeah, thank you, memory. I knew I screwed that up. But I said, I'm going to live my life different. I'm going to be way more balanced. I'm going to be home for dinner. I'm going to coach my kids' sports. I'm going to tell people who I really am. And so I used my storytelling and how I changed to share who I am. And part of that is my faith journey. And that's how I bring it up. And I think And I think about God's calling on me that, you know, work's important. It's a big part of the Bible, how, you know, work is if you're working for God, not for human. So when I'm at work, I want to be fully present, fully who I am. And back to your point about the mask, it's a beautiful metaphor because I found I am at my very best when I can be very authentically who I am. When I have to pretend to be something I'm not, then I am shit, excuse my French. I'm not good. Like, and I so feel and empathize with people who are like, you know, I've had this kind of, and I'm naturally an extrovert, but you know, P&G grooms general managers it's a very extroverted job. Mm-hmm. And so like very close friends of mine are just born and bred introverts. And to be extroverted all day, they go home and collapse. Mm-hmm. And they talk about the mat, not in the same way you do, which I'm going to start borrowing that from you and giving you full credit. But it's that whole idea that if you can't bring who you really are and have open discussions. And it doesn't mean people are going to agree with everything you think or everything you do, but it just means you're authentically who you are. So that's a very long answer to a great question.
Hey, it shows how great my question was that it took you that long to answer it. I'm kidding. No, not at all. I really appreciate the personal nature of it. You took us on a journey that I didn't know where it was going to go. And I'm glad that it had and has a happy ending. You know, comedians, I'm a comedian, and we're supposed to be really cynical and really pessimistic. And I've learned to become that. We can bookmark that. But I say this to people out here all the time. And I preface it by saying that I know I shouldn't say this as a comedian, but I live in awe of the human spirit. Mm. I do. I live in awe of the human spirit. And to hear a story of what you went through, and I have friends who have gone through things. I've gone through some stuff, but I've seen people and heard people who have really gone to hell and back. And in your case, it's faith. I don't know. I mean, I guess there was a song by the Mighty Mighty Bosstones called The Impression That I Get. I don't know if you remember the song from the 90s, but it was like, never had to knock on wood. I know someone who has, and I'm sure it isn't good. And it was this whole like speculation, like if he went through something really difficult, could he do it? Would even want to do it? And it was kind of a deep song for a ska band jam from the late 90s. But to me, it's like, that seems like that was your inflection point, mm-hmm. where it kind of came together for you. When did Crossroads start? Is this the beginning of that? I remember your being involved, Jim Bechtold's being involved. I don't think I ever went, but I'm good friends with a number of people who do go to Crossroads. Can you talk a little bit about Crossroads?
Yeah. So it started actually well before I started going there. It started in 1997. And like I mentioned, it was a place where people had given up on church, but not on God. Mm-hmm. And so there were four P&G couples that actually came together to take out home equity loans on their homes and put this thing together. And they were at the Hyde Park Methodist Church, or I'm sorry, the Hyde Park Middle School, I think is where they were. They didn't know how many people would show up. They hired a pastor, still there today, who was young at the time. And they said, we're going to see how this experiment goes. They put wires on people's cars and word of mouth. And Brian Tomes, the senior pastor, said, I turn around and I had no idea what to expect. It was full. It was like 250 people the first Sunday. And then, in any given weekend now, face to face or online, they reach 50,000 people. And
whoa.
Yeah, it's pretty remarkable. And for a few years in the late, like 2017, 18, 19 window, they were the fastest growing large church in the United States. So it's a pretty remarkable story when you think about, a place like Cincinnati where people say, oh, it's the Bible Belt. And of course, people believe in God there and, they go to church. But to have a church which drew people in that way is pretty doggone remarkable. And so it was interesting how I got connected there because I was Jim Bechtold, actually, talking about how God works and has a great sense of humor. Jim replaced me in Northeast Asia. So Jim took my job in Japan when I came back to the U.S. And he said, hey, there's the guy who's the pastor at Crossroads Church, you guys would absolutely hit it off. You'd be best buddies. I moved back in 2003 and Jim took my job then. He said, you should meet up with Brian. And so I reached out to Brian and he's like, I don't meet on Friday. It's my day off, which I understand. And I'm like, I travel all the time. So we never met. Jim moved back in 2006, put a small group together. And then Brian and I hit it off and we became fast friends. I'm like, I want to go to the church this guy leads and see what it's like. And what drew me to it was the fact that it brings people in, like I said earlier, who've given up on the church or people who don't know anything about it. And it's all about how do we serve others so they see the true light of Christ, the true light of God. And, a lot of times I believe that at least the Christian faith has become intertwined with political parties and, certain things that they're against. And I believe that the God of my Bible is for things, not always against things. I mean, yes, God, there are certain things that like he advises us not to do. That's why there's the Ten Commandments, tells us not to do. But God also talks very clearly, like in the New Testament of the Bible, he talks about the fact that what are the greatest commandments? Pharisees are trying to trap Jesus. And he's like, hey, the two greatest commandments are simple. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, might, strength, and love your neighbor as yourself. Those are the greatest commandments. Not go give this amount to your church or not go be against abortion or not go be against, like, no, it's like, love your neighbor, love God. Pretty daggone simple. We forget that. Mm-hmm. And that's where a lot of the divisiveness comes in, and it's not necessary. It's not what he intended. And so I think about that in the context of why has the church become so separated? And when you think about the great things that the Christian church has started, like public schooling, hospitals, you know, and during the plagues in Rome in the early days of the church, the reason the church spread so quickly when you study the history of it is, I mean, during the plagues in early Rome, it wasn't the Roman government took care of people that were dying from it. It was people of the church. Like that's how the faith took off. Like, hey, who are these people that are sacrificing their life to help others? Like, that's pretty cool. Mm-hmm. So anyway, all that to say, like, Crossroads tries to bring that. And what was interesting is back 2010, earlier than that, 2009, I think, Brian asked me, he's like, hey, would you give a message about how you build people or how you live out your faith or things like that at work? Because that is the first time I've ever honestly stood on a stage and talked about, like, here's how I integrate my faith. I'm like, mm-hmm. Are you going to fire me? Am I going to, you know, piss the people off in my organization who aren't believers? Am I going to, like, all these things went through my head. But I'm like, you know what? Back to the authenticity part. If they fire me because I am who I am, that means it's not the place I want to be.
Sure.
Right. And so, which is it? And I'll share a moment about Google and how that transcended that as well. But so anyway, Crossroads is just a unique place in that it reaches people who normally aren't reached in the church. A lot of times there's an impression, I felt this way. I mentioned to you, I was a creaster. I didn't feel worthy to be in church. I felt like I had to be better. And I think, you know, if you read the Christian Bible, one of the things that's very clear is that God meets you where you are. Like, show up. You don't have to fix yourself. My favorite Christian books is written by a guy named Philip Yancey. And it's What's So Amazing About Grace is the name of the book. And in it, the very first story in the book, when you open up the first page, is a woman who was arrested because she prostituted out her 2-year-old child. Hmm. She was arrested and this Christian faith-based counselor was meeting with her and he recommended, he's like, hey, have you ever thought about going to church because you feel awful about yourself? You feel like you don't belong. She's like, church, that's the last place I'd want to be. They would judge me more than I'm already judging myself or something like that. The reason that struck a chord with me is the church should be the most welcoming place. You don't have to be cleansed and excellent to go there. Come as you are, and that's where God meets you. And that's what I love about Crossroads. But I think that's the power of, like, a truly open place, is where people don't feel like they have to be perfect or polished or wear the right clothes or say. And I remember one of my favorite stories about one of the first times I went in, there was a couple on stage. And Brian started off by saying, hey, this was 2006. I don't want anybody talking about this outside. We're not going to put this online. Hmm. It was this couple who talked about this marital infidelity, both of them going through drugs and doing all stuff. And I was like, oh my God, they're talking about this at church. People talk about this at church, like real freaking issues that they're dealing with. But anyway, that's why I'm so compelled by that place, because it meets people where they are, which I think is so important in a world that's broken and people want something. And we try to fill our holes in our souls with things and activities that aren't fulfilling. And I think it's people of any faith or no faith. We live in a consumeristic society where we try to get our needs met through things, not through, like, deep relations and belief in something bigger than who we are. So, but anyway, that's why our church is so important to me.
You know, maybe I will name check a few people, and it's not really name dropping, but name checking some of the people I know who have gone to Crossroads. My friends, I don't know if you know Catherine and Casey Basil.
I do not.
Catherine and I worked together at P&G for a few years, and they're still two very dear friends of mine. And we talk probably every day, at least on text or something like that. And she always comes in with these great arguments, because Casey and I will talk about politics and economics, and she just wants to have fun and talk about more fun stuff. But she'll come in with a point that just, you know, neither one of us saw. And she's done this a couple of times, very importantly for me, that shaped my belief system. I said, you know, look, Hinduism is, you know, 5,000 years old, and we kind of had all of this stuff figured out. And then we have these Johnny come latelys who come along, and they have, you know, what have you guys really brought to the table? What have Christians really done? You know, and I'm kind of saying it in the same tone, right, too. I'm not fire and brimstone. I'm just kind of like pulling her leg, but I really want to know. I'm like, well, what did you add? What did you add to the mix that we hadn't already figured out? And she said, I will answer that question. She goes, I know you're saying that half in jest, but her answer to that was grace. She goes, I think that the idea of a warm universe and love and kindness and grace is missing from the Eastern religion. She's like, I'm not putting yours down. I said, no, I asked you a semi-offensive question. I expect maybe not an offensive answer or a semi-offensive answer, but I want a real answer. Let's go. Right. And I thought that was really, really insightful. And that really has stayed with me because my grandfather made it all the way to 98. He was not really an official priest, but he was a wise man in his village in India, northern India. And a Christian man had studied with him and was with him and reading and all these things. And, you know, he said, I'd like to convert. I'd like to become a Hindu. And my grandfather, this is decades ago, said to him, he said, what are you? You know, you're Christian, right? And he said, yeah. And he goes, well, tell me everything you know about your religion. And the man knew very little. And my grandfather's words to him were, go off and learn about your own religion first. And if after all of that, you still want to convert, I'm happy to talk to you about that. But I think you need to learn where you are first before you make this leap. And I thought that was was really wise.
Wow, your grandfather was a wise man. And I think what your friend mentioned as well, that you look at all the faiths of the world and you look at the differentiation, like I said earlier, there's way more commonality than differences. And so when you look at the differences, other faiths are what you do gets you to heaven, like your work.
Right.
But in the Christian faith, it's grace of God that gets you to heaven. Mm-hmm. Nothing you do. And in that book I mentioned earlier, there's a line he has in the back, and I think about this every day of my life. Nothing you do can make God love you more, and nothing you do can make God love you less. And grace is by definition an undeserved gift. And I think about it as a parent. You know, I have four kids, and man, there are days I don't like them very much, but I always love them. And I would give my life for them no matter what, like without even thinking. Mm-hmm. That's what God did for me. He came to this earth to figure out like why we were so wacky and to sacrifice his son for us. And, you know, are there a lot of confusing things about it? Most definitely. But I just know. I know to the core of my being that he is real. And, you know, that not only because, and I'm a very fact-based analytical guy. Mm-hmm. I used to have the best agnostic arguments ever against like how in the world could there be a God? But like the historicity, like the facts. There's a guy named Lee Strobel who wrote a book called The Case for Christ. And Lee was an atheistic legal writer for the Chicago Tribune. And wrote this incredible, his wife had a conversion to Christianity. And he's like, what in the world? She's like whacked out of her mind. Like, what in the heck is going on? And he said she was so different. He's like, okay, there's something, I need to investigate this as I would a story.
Sure.
So he proceeded to do this investigated journalism that ended with him becoming a follower of Christ and writing this book called The Case for Christ. And it was, I share like people who are kind of saying, hey, what are books that you would recommend somebody who's really trying to find out who they are, what they believe? And what's so amazing about grace, which talks about, and it says in that book, the only difference between the Christian faith and other faiths really is grace. And then The Case for Christ, because it is for people who are more analytical. In the New Testament, the Bible, the book of Hebrews, chapter 11, verse 1, it says, faith is being sure of what you hope for, but certain of what you cannot see. And I used to have that on my license plate in California, which created very interesting conversations for me. But I think about that, like there's only so much that our analytics can get us to.
True.
There always is a leap, right? There's a leap to what you believe and why you believe it.
Sure.
And it's never a knock against anyone else. It's like, okay, there's a schism between what is known and what is unknown. And it's like, to me, God bridges that divide for me. He's reaching from my known to my unknown side, and I trust that. So
one of my best friends, Azhar Usman, as the name would betray, is Muslim, and he knows the Quran and all of that. And we've had these very interesting discussions to your point. And another Muslim friend of mine, Abu Bakr, says, you know, you can't be a prophet in your own land. And it's so true, right? You're just not even respected at home. You can tell your family the same stuff, but then you know, someone else will say it to your wife. Just go, like, oh, yeah, that's a good point. Like, I've been telling you that the whole time. You can't be a prophet in your own land. You have to travel. You have to go out and preach elsewhere. And Uzzer, he came over a few weeks ago, and sometimes it's just so infuriating to talk to him because I'm like, well, how do you know? And how do you know Islam is right? And, you know, in your head and all this. He goes, well, let's start upstream. You know, what does it mean to know something? And I'm like, oh my God, like we're going to start this far upstream, like the epistemology. And he goes, no, but what does it mean to know something? Like, is it in your head? Is it in your gut, your heart, your spirit, your soul? Like, he goes, maybe I don't know it here, but I know it here. I know it in my gut. I know it in my soul. And my best friend actually is a WASP. He's a white Anglo-Saxon Protestant from Cincinnati. We've known each other since fifth grade. He's up in Seattle. And I go to him for advice all the time. You know, I had a falling out with someone very close to me. And, you know, he lives, what would Jesus do? I said, what should I do? You know, what could I do? And I've noticed that if you say what you could do to people, it's very opening. Because when I say, you know what you should do, it's judgment. But when I say, you know what you could do, it's possibilities. And people open up like, oh, yeah. What could I do?
Love that.
So he said Jesus would continually prostrate himself. You just keep coming and you keep showing grace and you keep showing love. And even though you're being wronged, and you're being wronged, I'm listening to your stories, you are being wronged in this. That's not relevant. He's like, what's relevant is how do you want to be? And that's why in arguments, if I'm sorry, I'll say I'm sorry. There are people who are like, well, I'll say sorry if you say you're sorry. Well, that's garbage then. Like, no, but are you sorry? Then say you're sorry. And I don't want to behave that way. To your point about, you know, swearing or cursing or whatever, it's like, that's why I work clean as a comedian. I tell dirty jokes off stage and I laugh and I'll drop an F-bomb and at a party. But on stage, it's like, I don't know these people. I don't know all 300 of them. I don't know all 3,000 of them, whatever it is. I'm going to be that loose in conversation. I mean, when I meet someone for the first time, we have neighbors. And I said this to my wife. I go, you notice they never swear? She goes, oh, yeah. I go, yeah. So I don't swear around them now. Not that I don't swear a lot anyway. But I go, I'm going to be careful. Mm-hmm. But it's funny how that leads you to, are they religious?
Yeah.
And you're like, maybe they are, maybe they're not. But again, getting back to the idea of like these conversations I've had with Uzzer about Islam and with John about Christianity, they've always led me back to your point. I had read something that was, and you've hit on this a little bit, Kirk, already, which is we bond according to our similarities and we grow according to our differences.
Yep, that's exactly right. Well said.
And I come back to that. And John Langdon has been a great guide for that. I don't think any of Christ's teachings are in conflict with Hinduism. I can't think of anything where I've read, and I've read Mere Christianity. I've read a few of the books of the Bible and certainly gone to Bible study. Every Christmas, we would go to church with this family that we knew. And I've never heard anything in the faith where I was like, no, that's wrong, or that just doesn't compute.
Yeah. And it's interesting. I love what you're sharing about your friend. I mean, I think the cool thing about Jesus is he was equally truth and grace.
Hmm.
So yes, Jesus prostrates himself and forgives, but he also turned the tables of the money changers at the temple. He also called the Pharisees snakes. He called people out on their shit.
Yeah.
Like he did. Like he was not afraid to do that.
Yeah.
At the same time, go and sin no more. Like he was filled with grace. And so, and I think about that from a work construct, I tend to be, my orientation is truth, black and white. My wife, she's all grace. So together, we're a combustible mixture of truth and grace. But if we take the pieces of the truth and the grace and bring them together, that's what I think the Christ was on earth, was this unique, weird mix of truth and grace. Because I think we're oriented toward one or the other, right? Mm-hmm. I want black and white.
Yep.
Or I live in shades of gray and I give people the benefit of the doubt. Like that's how that works. And so it works sometimes when I'm tough, like I'm firm, but I'm clear. And I've been in business 33 years. I've let go of a lot of people, but I've done it in, I hope, in a compassionate and kind and careful way. So I spoke truth,
mm-hmm.
but I also gave grace. And that's, I think for me, kind of living out your faith at work, to your point, like your Hindu faith and your principles, being true to those and who you are allows you to do what you do better, I think. Because no faith, like, yeah, you have the fringes of every faith. Like there are
totally,
there are wackadoodle Christians, there are wackadoodle Muslims, there are wackadoodle, I'm sure of it. Like in every,
sure.
every group of people has wackadoodles, but it doesn't mean the whole faith believes that. And I think, mm-hmm. like you said, you you have the ability to be who you are and be the best version of yourself. Because if it's really who you are and you're acting on that, the faiths at their core are good. Mm-hmm. They're all about like, how do we transcend this broken human state and be bigger and better and have a higher order purpose? And so you kind of boil it down to that.
You know, the other thing that Catherine talked about, the point that she made was actually, and this will be a good, I hope, pivot. Although I think pivot is a startup word for failed, but a good segue into politics. I know we have only a few minutes left. And, you know, while we're on religion, we may as well throw politics into it because I think a lot of
time,
let's go. We're already in taboo land. And to me, I always say that politics is the new religion. I feel like if you went out there and you said, I don't know, Jesus wasn't all that, you'd offend people. But if you're like, Trump ain't all that, oh my gosh, the people that would come to you with vehemence would be probably a lot stronger right now. Catherine made the point about abortion. She said, the problem with that debate, there are many problems with the debate, but without picking a side here in the context here, it's just more about, she goes, they're having two different conversations. Choice is not the opposite of life. One group is talking about choice and how good choice is, and the other group is talking about life and how life is. Those are not, you're having two different conversations. And I thought that was a really, really insightful point, which is, yeah, you're not even, there's no way to split the difference between choice and life. Those are two very large concepts. And for me, some of my best friends, including John, are not fans of Donald Trump's. And they feel like I feel, which is that he's all of the seven deadly sins to a 10. I can't name anyone more gluttonous, more greedy, more prideful, more lustful. Like if you had to make an antichrist, and I know that's going to offend some people that are going to be like, I can't believe you said that. No, but I'm saying that based on facts and things that are out there and things that have not been denied. It's been really, really, really difficult to watch people with whom I grew up go, and this happens on the left too. I'm not saying that. I have friends that I have a very difficult time speaking to now because, and actually I forgot to ask this question earlier with you. Maybe you can weave it into your answer, which is, do you find it harder now in this land of PC and the world in which we live now to talk about your Christian faith? It almost seems like Christians are one of the persecuted groups in society that it's okay, quote unquote, to persecute. Mm-hmm. And you see that happening in India too, with Narendra Modi, the prime minister, championing the Hindu cause, but is he championing it at the expense of Christians and Muslims and other people that are specifically Muslims more than anyone else? And that debate can be had. But for me, I think it's been very, very hard and heartbreaking to see what is happening to this country, because I grew up really with no racism. In Fairfield, Ohio, I was a class president. I'll be throwing the reunion again. I felt like my race was not even an issue. We learned about the Indians, the Navajo, and our mascot was the Fairfield Indians, as your wife will remember. Yeah. And it wasn't until 11th grade where people were like, Raj, you should be the mascot. You're a Fairfield Indian. And they were saying it playful, you know, jest. But it didn't even occur to us, because I was like, no, I'm Indian. Those are Indians, like Navajo. Like they were a different world and all that. It was a complete non-factor as far as I remember. And I've gone back to ask friends, was I blind to this? And you guys were all laughing behind my back. They're like, no, we just thought of you as a guy who also went to Young Life meetings, even though you were Hindu. And so all of that to say, I threw a lot at you here, but I guess I would love to hear you talk a little bit about, you know, religion in this time of politics. You hinted at it, yeah, which kind of opened the door a little bit for me to talk about how you see it being used. And okay, I'll stop talking and let you talk.
No, it's a really good question. And I think about this a lot because, so here's my fundamental belief. Step back. It's the worst period in European history was called the Dark Ages. Mm-hmm. Guess who ruled Europe during the Dark Ages? The church.
Oh.
So when you think about the concept of any faith leading what should be a earthly thing, when faith and earthly things intersect, I believe absolute power corrupts absolutely. And so when you think about, you know, the reason Martin Luther broke off from the Catholic Church, the notion of an indulgence, the church was raising money to build Rome, to build the Roman Catholic Church. And so they gave indulgences for people who were in purgatory or the in-between, so their relatives could be sent to heaven. Like, really? That's what Martin Luther was like, wait a minute, this isn't what the Bible says. Holy smokes, this is wrong. And so I think one is, while we are a country founded on Judeo-Christian principles, you cannot deny that. When you read the constitutions, mm-hmm, of the state of Virginia, the state of Massachusetts, very face-centric. When you read the writings of Thomas Jefferson, of John Adams, of Alexander Hamilton, of George Washington, very face-centric. Mm-hmm. But people go, well, separation of church and state. It was separation of the population from a state church, meaning the Church of England, which became the fact of faith. Mm-hmm. So I add all those things together and say, I don't want a theocracy. Our job as faithful followers is to create something that people will say, wow, I want to be a part of that. Fourth, forcing someone to love God or believe in God does not create connection to God. That's just man-made religion. Mm-hmm. Relationship is a choice. You choose to follow something because it moved you, it changed you to your core. That's what I never use the word religious to describe myself. I say I'm faithful. Mm. I have faith in what I can't see is true. And I have faith in a relationship with Christ and God that I believe and I know is there. And so I don't believe that I look at the countries in the Middle East right now, whether it's Iraq, you know, Afghanistan, where we just had, you know, the Taliban come back into power, and that's a theocracy. That's a religion. Like, yes, they're the fringe, but like whenever people of religion run things, you can't force it down people's throat. Like, I just fundamentally disagree with that. And I think the notion of absolute power corrupting, absolutely. I just think back to some of the worst things in humanity have been done under the auspices of faith. The Inquisition, you know, the Crusades, mm-hmm. the Dark Age. I could go down a list of like all this, or the jihadists, like mm-hmm. all in the name of faith. Like, that is not why God created the world, to go out and disrupt it and destroy it and hurt people. That isn't at all what he did. So that's kind of one point. The second point is, I think where things get a little wonky is people who are professed in their faith, at least in the Christian faith, get held to a higher standard. It's very clear in the New Testament, the Bible, when you are a declared person of faith, mm-hmm. you are held to a higher standard, but you don't judge other people by that same standard. In the New Testament, Paul, writing his letters to the Ephesians and to the Romans, he was very clear that, like, you can't judge other people, but people who are declared, like, yes, you hold each other accountable. It's an accountability thing. So my issue with faith today in politics is they become intertwined. And I do not think that is at all. If you read the Bible, Jesus said one of the things when they said, well, the Jews thought he was coming to like take over government. So the Pharisees were trying to trick him, and Sadducees, and ask him, like, well, you know, paying tax to Caesar, and whose face is on the coin? And Jesus said, give to Caesar what is Caesar's, give to God what is God's. And I think what he's saying there is like, hey, don't get all hung up in this worldly stuff and try to make it about God. Caesar is a secular leader, and give to Caesar what the rules and the law dictates. So I also am appalled by Trump. Appalled. And I, for the life of me, cannot figure out people of faith who blindly hope, like, follow him. I cannot on any level understand that. And let me say that my political persuasion is right down the middle, and I lean more Republican than I do Democrat. Mm-hmm. But I cannot. Now we're all fallen. We all have our faults, for sure. But you said, you know, the seven deadly sins. Are there policies of his that I agree with? Certainly. Are there policies of the Democrats? Certainly. But we've gotten into this phase where if you're a believer, somehow you've got to mm-hmm. buy into the Republican Party. I find it interesting, like, you know, again, not the Republican Party I believe in, but on one hand, it's like, oh my gosh, you know, the Gestapo is off to force us to get vaccinations and they're the worst thing ever. And then you flip it and it's like, you know, we have death penalty and we're going to, like, okay, you're killing someone that you don't believe. If you just take the principles on the left, you take the extreme left and it's like,
yeah,
we're going to force you to take vaccines, mm-hmm. but then don't touch my body around abortion. You know, you can put these contradictions on
hypocrisy.
So politics in general make my head hurt, which is why I don't think faith should ever take a political stand. I think you choose the best person based on being the most right, mm-hmm. according to what you believe. But I also believe that in a democracy, in a representative democracy, compromise is critical to progress. You look at the dysfunction of our national government. It's an embarrassment.
This is
not what our founding fathers had in mind. I mean, I've read all the Federalist Papers, and I would consider myself pretty astute on governmental and historical facts. And This is not what the founding fathers, that one party gets in power and they start investigating the other or block funding or let the government default. That's not what they intended. It was figure out, like, no party is right, right? There's degrees of rightness. It's how do you get the most right for the most people? And then you make choices and you compromise and you move on. But we've created this polarization, this litmus. If you don't believe this or don't believe that, therefore we won't buy into it. And so to your last question to me of, can I talk about my faith now? I have had probably the best faith-based conversations over the last 5 years, 6 years, post 2016 with friends in my faith, with friends of other faiths, just because you are honest about who you are. And you're, I don't ever take that, well, I'm Christian, therefore I believe in the Republican Party. And we've gotten into the only person we should worship is God. No one else should be worshiped, and particularly politicians. Like, they will fall short. And so, yeah, everybody falls short. Everybody's a sinner. But by the same token, is that what we want to represent the greatest nation on earth? And I do not think so.
I'm happy to hear you say that. It's why I have learned to become a pessimist. As I mentioned earlier, I go, yeah, I'm a pessimist in trading. I don't believe that. Actually, it's funny because at the time it was Rudy Giuliani on a satellite hookup. I was at the HCRC, as it was called at the time, in Mason.
Oh, yeah.
And they piped in all these leaders, and you probably were there. Maybe you were one of the speakers.
Was it Trump, the last speaker, when they cut it off? This was like 2006.
You know, although I did go see Donald Trump speak in Dayton at another event entirely. I still have the brochure. I did a whole show called The Man in the Middle about politics, and I still have that brochure to this day. But it was Rudy Giuliani. And to me, he's the epitome of this. He's a personification of how America has just fought. Like, he was America's Mary, did a great job post 9/11 and cleaned up New York. And we could debate the pros and cons of how he did that. But he, to Jack Nicholson's point, you know, you want me on that wall, you need me on that wall. He was on that wall, and he brought New York back from what it was to a Disneyland kind of situation in a good way, and that he deteriorated. But one thing Rudy Giuliani said at the time, with which I totally agreed, was leaders have to be optimists. If you're a pessimist, that's fine. You can be a pessimist, but then you can't lead. You have to believe a better tomorrow is coming. Otherwise, how are you leading us? You have to be leading us to a better place.
I couldn't agree with you more. And I am an eternal optimist. Mm-hmm. I believe, and I have this debate with my wife all the time, I think the world is no worse off than it's ever been. When you look through the course of history, the election of 1796, 1800, very split. John Adams won, and then went to
John Adams and then Thomas Jefferson.
You know, when it swung because Aaron Burr, you know, came in, split the vote, and deeply divided. Back then, the country wanted to align. Some part of the country wanted to align with France. Another part of the country wanted to align with England. Like, very divisive. Intervention, non-intervention in the 40s. That was the last time there was a fissure. Like, there's now the 1960s with Vietnam, like deep divisions in the country. But I also believe that our 24/7 news cycle, social media, the bias toward headlines that create a shock value, that when you read the article, you're like, that isn't what it really said.
Right.
Like, you're getting to read it, and I read it, and I'm like, come on. You just
let's clickbait.
Fan the flames, and it's irreputable. But I don't believe that the press is the enemy of the people. I just believe the press is trying to make money, and they're marketers. They understand what it gets us to click, and they figure it out. But I am more optimistic than ever, because I think that you have the 5% cuckoos on either side, and you have the 90% that I believe are just, they're just good, but they might disagree with you on things, but they're going to help their fellow person. They're going to, you know, I see that every day. I think recently, you know, for those in the U.S., I was at the Bengals game when the young man, Damar Hamlin from Buffalo Bills, had a cardiac arrest. I have never been in a sporting event in my life where I've seen both teams get together, hold hands, pray, you know, like, say, we're not going to play this game, fans dead silent, people praying out, like, and the national reaction to that, like, hey, if you read the headlines, you'd be pessimistic. But if you really know the people, you'd be optimistic. And I don't know, call me a misguided optimist. But I think, again, like, this craziness we see at a national level, that isn't everyday good human beings. And there are people, like, we have a place at Norris Lake in Tennessee, rural Tennessee. And, like, we had a bunch of people working on our house last year over. We did smoked some meats and sat outside and drank beer and had all these smoked meats. And the folk plumbers and electricians and carpenters were all sitting around, and, like, I guarantee you 100% of them voted for Trump. Guarantee you 100%. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't because they thought he was a great guy and they were following us because, like, hey, we believe in individualism and we believe in, you know, not. But you're like, they would tell you why. And you're like, we could disagree. We could agree to disagree, like states' rights versus national rights and the founding of our country. Mm-hmm. But ultimately, I think they're good people who just have a different belief in where the country should go. And it's a different worldview. And I respect debating a worldview. I don't respect cult following a person. Like, that's, I just don't agree with that. But if you want to debate your principle of a worldview that says government should be smaller, we shouldn't you know, do this, do that, you know, should abortion be legal or not legal? Like, debate that worldview. Mm-hmm. Don't follow a party or a person blindly out the window and say they're right at everything they do. That's just not right. That's not true.
I could not agree more. And I think you and I came up with a really good analogy here as we're in our closing minutes. But, you know, to some point you said that the headline was one thing and the body of the article was another. It's almost like the leaders are the headlines and the body of the article is the people. You know, like the headline was all screwed up, but the body of the article, the people are good. And whenever I get down on the country, my mom reminds me, they came here in 1971. My mom goes, but Americans are fundamentally good people. And they just are. They've been welcoming. They've been graceful. They've been really, really good to us. And I think part of this issue with the left is there is no, I read an article a long time ago that was, they offer no path to redemption. Like, at least the right, at least the Christians offer you always there's a path to redemption. You accept Jesus Christ as your Lord and Savior, and you have a path to redemption always. And this is if you transgress and you're canceled, what's the path back? What's the apology? Offer me a path back because I made an honest mistake, and they need to come up with their commandments or their dogma around that. And Hinduism talks about this. There are four different phases. And the worst one is Kali Yoga, and we're in Kali Yoga. But the thing about Satyog, which is the best one, it's easy to be good when things are good. It's hard to be good when things are bad.
Yep.
And at this time of trying to be a leader, and with my son being 17 months old, he's going to look at me and say, Dad, what did you do? And if I go, well, I bitched and I complained and I moaned, well, then you didn't really help. Like, it's much harder to be the people who are playing in the quartet as the Titanic goes down, as opposed to being the people who are helping the ship sink.
Well, you know, it's so good you said that, because, you know, I had a boss who used to tell me crisis reveals character. And, you know, on the business, like in a heated moment, like how do you react to things, or in a downturn? Are you just like fire and brimstone jerk, or are you really trying to help people through it? And it's crisis reveals character. I think it was, it was Martin Luther King Jr. who said, it's not where a man stands during times of convenience and comfort. It's where he stands during times of crisis and conflict. And I think that to me is, you know, that's the epitome of who you really are as a person. Where is your redemption, path to redemption? Like, I read these stories about people who have no reason to forgive someone. Their daughter dies in a car accident with a drunk driver, and they give them immediate, you know, grace. And I think about the head coach of the Phoenix Suns. Such an incredible guy.
Yeah, Monty Williams.
Monty Williams, thank you. His wife got killed in the car accident. Jeez. Someone hit her and killed her. Five kids. He was the assistant head coach of the Oklahoma City Thunder at the time. And he gave her a eulogy. I've never heard anything like it. During it, he's like, hey, God called her home. Like, you know what? I'm going to celebrate her. And the other thing is, I want everybody to remember that poor man's family that hit her. They're all grieving too. He ran into her and he killed her, but he's gone too. And
wow.
We need to pray for him and his family. I mean, I watched him and I was just like, my heart sank. I'm like, that is grace. That is an undeserved gift. And hate kills the hater. If you cannot forgive someone first, to one of something you said earlier, it will burn inside of you and it will cause the things to go bad that will ultimately bring more grief to you than it will the other person. And I just think that in this age we live in, when we lead with grace, when we lead with humility, authenticity, vulnerability, and we're a human being to those that we should be to, we'd live in a much better place. We would be in a much different place instead of being right and wrong, like be humans and realize we're going to be right and wrong. That's just the way we are. We're built that way. But it's how do we move beyond that and get the very best possible solution for the very most people. Maybe I'm too simplistic and naive, but that's where the sweet spot of what makes a country great comes in, I think. It's the middle. It's not the extremes. It's the middle where greatness lies. The hardest thing is to say I was wronged and I'm going to forgive first.
But I know.
If you look at the greatest transformations in history of people, of countries, you know, I think about Germany. You know, think about that country, what it went through in World War II and what they did. But it was when they made an apology of like, hey, we as a country, it wasn't that leaders necessarily did any of that, but they apologized and said what we did was wrong. It was horrific. Mm-hmm. It allowed them to move on. Because if you don't move on, if you don't ask for forgiveness, whether you get it or not, if you don't give it, you never move on. And I think the people I meet who are the most broken, who have addictions, I have, unfortunately, two siblings who were severe alcoholics who've since pulled out of it, but they have unresolved issues that are only solvable through grace. And like you fill those holes with things that are not healthy most of the time. Hate, alcohol, drugs, people who aren't your spouse, that get on the list, like all the things you could, you know, you're chasing the Joneses. So you know, you have a hole you got to fill because you want something and you cheat your company or you, you know, you get on the list, right? That's because we're chasing something and usually it's some sort of redemption. And the only place you get that is God. It isn't through anything human. It isn't through anything. You know, I was watching Josh Allen, who's the quarterback of the Buffalo Bills, talk last week at the press conference after the game. They beat the New England Patriots, and he got choked up because he said, man, when that Buffalo Bill ran the opening kickoff back touchdown, right? Josh Allen got choked up. He's like, guys, this is supernatural. Like, you can't make this up. Like, we haven't run one back this year.
In like 10 years.
Like, this is supernatural. This is God. Yeah, and he choked up and he was like crying. He's like, I walked around telling guys, God is real. God is real. God is real. And he kept repeating it. Those are just examples of where like people want that. Mm-hmm. People want what Josh Allen had. Like, you want that to be this healthy interaction with challenge and struggle to come out of that with something like that storybook kickoff return. You know, most of us don't get the storybook kickoff returns, right? We struggle with it. We struggle with what happened to us as a kid. We struggle. You know, my wife is like, I tease her, like, do you wear like a barbed wire bra and leather underwear all the time? Like, she is so tough.
Yeah.
But I think about what happened to her. Like, how many kids recover from their dad dying when they're 3 years old, killed by a drunk driver, their mom being married multiple times, you know, other things happen to her. And I'm like, man, she has the most unbelievable countenance and faith. I just look at her and she's always filled the issues with God. And she's never filled them with other things. And that's the differentiator. And I think why people, even in a workplace setting, and I know we're wandering around in the conversation, but in a workplace setting, when people see something different, they're like, hey, why is that person different in how they respond to a crisis, how they behave in meetings, how they deal with opportunities to cheat, but they don't. You create this opportunity to build into people. And I think back in my career, people I respected the most were the most principled. And I know you were at P&G. A lot of people listening are going to be from P&G. But the company I joined that is still there today is a principle-based company. Like, there's things we stand for. And they never waver from those principles. And I think if people, you know, again, back to the political piece, if the parties had principles they didn't waver from and said, hey, these, no, we're going to compromise on things. These are our principles. This is what we stand for. Like, we're not going to lie. We're not going to cheat. We're not going to do. But you know what? There's a national schism over the issue of abortion, or there's a national schism over debt. There's national, whatever it is. And we've got to compromise and figure out a way to run this. And like, he had that. If he had a P&G-like principle-based approach to these things, I think we'd be in a much different place in many ways, in our societies around the world, and the way our institution runs, the way our businesses run. You know, how many businesses fail? Because someone cheats the company, someone does, you know, make a terrible decision based on self-worth issues, or they're trying to, you know, show like, well, I can do this deal better than you can. And they get up the price and then they fall on their face.
It's ego. So, Kirk, anything else you want to add to this? I mean, I loved every bit of this conversation and I appreciate your vulnerability and your grace and your kindness. And anything else you want to tack on to the end of this? I feel like I got out everything I wanted to.
Yes, I think we covered every taboo topic that you're not supposed to talk about in an open forum. But I really appreciate the time to share these things. I don't know if I gave anybody anything interesting or important, but
lots.
You know, I just think being true to who you are just opens the aperture on so many other things in your life. And I think for me, you know, my transformation gave me the opportunity, I think, to be a better husband, a better dad, a better follower, a better friend, a better employee. I think there's so many things that gave me, I joke with my wife, if I wouldn't have married her, I probably would have been divorced by now. And I think, you know, because she kept me on the path toward my ultimate redemption. And doesn't, like I said, doesn't mean that I didn't make mistakes after I found who God was. But I just think finding the people that build the community around you in your life. And I love that you talk to your friends every day. Mm-hmm. That's so important. Your spouses, your, like the network, the relationships and the network are what I just read a study. I think it posted in the Wall Street Journal. It said the headline was, and it's true actually. It said, if you want to live longer, have more friends.
I read that too.
Yeah. And it was a great article and the data was irrefutable that surround yourself with people who love you and you love, and your life's richer and longer and more meaningful. And I think we're in a very scary place where people are, you know, getting in front of a computer all day and not cultivating those relationships, and the pandemic didn't help. But I think we've been drifting toward that with social media for a long time. And I just want to say, like, value those relationships we've all built in our P&G days. And I still, some of my closest friends in the world are my, you know, P&G colleagues, the family I grew up with. And no matter where, how long it's been since I've talked to them, I just pick right up where we left off. And it was so meaningful. So I appreciate being able to come back out here again. I've been able to have one of these, host Susie Deering, who was the former CMO at Ford, and do this. So I'm honored and privileged to be able to do it.
Very cool. Thank you so much, Kirk Perry, for all of your time. And we really, really appreciate it. All the best to you for 2023 and beyond.
Thank you very much.
And that's our show. Like what you heard? Please subscribe and leave us a review on your favorite podcasting platform. For show notes about this episode, links to things mentioned, or requests for sponsorship, visit pgalums.com/podcast or email pgalumpod@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you.
Learnings from Leaders is a production of the P&G Alumni Network, a global nonprofit founded by former P&Gers committed to community, enrichment, and philanthropy. With more than 45,000 registered members worldwide, the network connects alums through global conferences, local chapters, industry events, and online content. Our nonprofit foundation supports economic empowerment in communities around the world. To find out more, visit pgalums.com.
That's it for this week. I've been Rajiv Sathyal.
And I'm still Raman Segal. Thanks for joining Learnings from Leaders, the P&G Alumni Podcast. We'll see you next time.